My name is Ralph White, and I'm an alcoholic. Can you hear me? Okay. If he can hear me, we're good. I'd like to thank the committee for asking me to come out this evening and share. And I don't know where I want to start tonight. You know, you might be sitting out there new to the program of Alcoholics Anonymous. If you are, I want to welcome you. Probably like I was, early in recovery, took me to a big meeting. Cedars-Sinai Hospital was a really big meeting. I don't know if I was totally surrendered then. It's some cues, I think, looking back. And that's the only way. My sponsor always talk about life being lived forward but understood backwards. And looking back at some stuff that I can look at and identify as maybe some key things in recovery that are markers. This was 1985, and I didn't realize, I thought I was surrendered then. I didn't realize until hindsight that not really. I was sitting in a meeting at Thalian's, big place, and a speaker was in front of the group, and he was making people laugh, like John Shire's class clown, you know, doing real, but he was making people laugh, and everybody was laughing but me, because I didn't see nothing funny. You know, what y'all laughing at? Ain't nothing funny about being up in here. This is life and death serious. I thought if I present serious, that means I am serious. I'm one of those kind of guys. Life and death serious, you know. Not funny. And I didn't know the relationships. I didn't know that the more committed I am to this deal, the freer I am to laugh. I thought the total opposite. I was really closed up. I was really, you know, I don't see nothing funny. I don't know what they're laughing at. They're not serious about this recovery thing. I was about 20-something days in, too. You know, and I'm talking about other people. But the thing I really, but the thing that I remember the most about that night, and I don't know why that's coming up tonight, but I don't know why most things come up when I'm talking. The thing I remember most about that night was I was thinking to myself, I can't wait till I'm the one standing up in front of everybody, you know, delivering, because I had it all twisted. The ego part, the everybody looking at me part, the most important person part. I was really stuck in that. And so if you knew and you thinking, damn, I can't wait till I'm up in front of everybody and get the speed, that's really a sign of work in the program. Or if on the other hand, you're on the other end of that tip and you knew. If you're thinking to yourself, I'll never be able to get in front of people and talk. Will I be able to get this thing? What I'm doing right now don't have a whole lot to do with, I'm talking about recovery. It doesn't have a whole lot to do with living the program of recovery. And this program is a living program. It's within the grasp. It's within the reach of anybody under the sound of my voice right now. So don't trip off that. Curiously, I do get to stand up here some couple of years later, and I get to talk about this thing. I believe in a couple of things. You know, I believe in this fellowship. I strongly believe in Alcoholics Anonymous. I believe in this power you guys introduced me to that's done what Bill describes in the book is, you know, the seemingly impossible. I believe in this fellowship and I believe in this power. And call me square, call me corny. We used to talk about it a whole lot more when I first came. And I still believe in miracles. And if you've been miracle, like a lot of people in the room, you can't help but want to talk about it. So you guys got me out here, and I'm going to talk about it. I'm going to talk about this program. I'm going to talk about this process. I'm going to talk about the men and women. And the thing about coming out this weekend is it's a lot of people that do stuff in Alcoholics Anonymous, and they like doing the tour and the whirlwind. And John and, you know, and you guys are working a brother this weekend. You know, I'm out here tonight. I'm talking tomorrow, then I'm talking some more tomorrow night. You know, I'm sick. I'll be sick. I'm sick of me in advance, right? but I like this thing of ours. I like to call it this thing of ours. It made me feel gangster. You know, out of my our thing, you know, our thing, you know. The people that's laughing know me. The other people that's kind of getting squirrely, they like, why did they bring this dude up here? What the hell is he talking about? You know, hang on. You know, we're a storytelling society. And although tomorrow I get the opportunity to talk in a different way, be talking in a workshop format, and I'll be talking about some of the, I guess I'll be talking about some of what it is that is the basis of our program of recovery, which is different than our fellowship. Tonight I'm going to do what it is we do, because we're a storytelling society. You know, we tell stories. And I'm a guy that grew up loving stories. We're a three legacy program. I'll talk about that some more probably tomorrow. But tonight, I'm going to talk about this guy that you see standing in front of you tonight. And I fell in love with the program fellowship before I fell in love with the program. And we're a three legacy program, Unity, Recovery, and Service. And that means if you knew, and we throw around words that are not familiar to me at first, legacy, what the hell is that talk? There are three parts to our program, Unity, Recovery, and Service. The Unity part we're doing right now, fellowshipping. It's the meetings. It's what I bring to the program at first, treats the body. I come to the program, and I fell in love with the fellowship before I fell in love with the program. I'm one of these guys. Storytelling, I love stories. As a kid, you know, one of my first addictions was reading. You know, I read, you know, I got some brothers and three of us, you know, we read voraciously. We read all the time. And I love TV programs. I read comic books. That's why I like this Black Panther thing that's out. You know, I read comic books. I read novels. I read, you know, biographies. I read sports books. I read. So I was ready made for you guys when I got to the fellowship, you know. So those of you who are big book thumpers, those of you who get involved in the book and in the process of recovery, you know, don't forget the stories. You know, I got some good friends that talk about, I'm not going to share a long drunkologue. You know, check this out. I told you I believe in miracles. And one of the things that is the most miraculous thing that I love going to a meeting, you know, and looking at you. That's a sweet little girl like you doing up in here at a place like this with folk like us. I love looking at that. And then you get up here and you tell your story. And I'm like, ooh, please don't leave us. You know, I'll be like, you know. I love those stories, you know, because that's our power. That's what we have. That's what we do. You can't appreciate where it is that I am today that I'll share with you if you don't know where I come from. You know, you'll get a lot of information over the weekend. Hopefully you'll get some information that'll stick with you and that'll hang with you. Those that'll be over the whole weekend, you'll get information tonight. And I hope that you get some information that you can take with you. But the strength and the power of Alcoholics Anonymous is not necessarily the information that we get at our meetings. You know, the information is cool, but the reason I go to meetings, I look for the transfer. I look for the transformation. This is a transformational program. I look for the lady that looks like the soccer mom. What the hell are you doing up in here with us? Because you wasn't looking like the soccer mom when you took that first one, you know. And that's the power of Alcoholics Anonymous. So we talk about our stories. And so when I first came around you guys, I fell in love with the stories, you know. And I wanted to get a hard story, too. You know, I used to love my first home group was 9604 South Figueroa in South Central Los Angeles. Cats would be up in there talking about, you know, some of the things they had done. In the place that, and I would be like stuck on the stories. And I started going to meetings. And why keep going to meetings? Why be in a 12-step program and not want to practice the 12 steps? I'm one of these guys that everything I get into, I get all the way in. I'm not a half-measure guy, you know. I collected baseball cards. I could tell you when Elgin Baylor was averaging a triple, you know, what he averaged back in the playoffs in 60s. You know, I could tell you, you know, I subscribed to High Times. You know, I'm that kind of guy. You know, what I get into, I get all the way into it. So why be in a 12-step program and not get into the 12 steps? So as a result of being around here for a while and listening and seeing and going around some places, and they kept where I come from. I've been to a lot of meetings and people said they didn't hear about the steps. I don't know that AA. From the day I hit the rooms, they talked about the 12 steps and they talked about the big book, Alcoholics Anonymous. I got interested in that. People made it interesting and they made it inviting and they made it appealing. And some people made it so appealing and so inviting that my brother and I at the same time, you know, we asked for some people to take us through the book the way they had gone through the book. And as a result of that, I started going through the big book, Alcoholics Anonymous. And that's the second part of our program, the second legacy, recovery, the 12 steps. Unity, the first legacy. Second legacy, recovery. And as a result of going through the 12 steps, I got what it is that we get. Spiritual awakening as a result of those steps. That's the one promise in Alcoholics Anonymous. Not the girl, not the car, not the house. Spiritual awakening as a result of the steps. What do you do with a woke up spirit? Put it in the service. Third legacy. And that's the key. That's the real deal. That's the people that know this recovery thing on a whole different level. The people who really know what this deal is. The ones sitting at the table when I walked up in here. The ones who put together the flyers and handed them out. The ones who work behind the scenes. I call them the shadow soldiers. You know, I'm sitting up here, all eyes on me. I'm doing the spotlight work in Alcoholics Anonymous. But I call them the shadow soldiers. Those are the ones who get up at 7 or 8 o'clock at night. They go to the hall. They fire up the coffee pot. They wait for Ralph White to show up. Seventh game of the World Series, they go to the hall, they fire up the coffee pot, they wait for Ralph White to show up. March Madness, they go to the hall, they fire up the coffee pot, they wait for Ralph White to show up. You know, and I'm so grateful for the men and women, the shadow soldiers, who waited for a drunk like me. You know, and that is the, you know, that's our program, that's the process, that's the program of recovery that I know about. There's two kinds of speakers to me. And I know I'm probably, you know, the only person that thinks, you know, because the politically correct thing to say is, it ain't no bad speakers in Alcoholics Anonymous. I'm not the correct guy, you know, because, you know, I'm in Alcoholics Anonymous. So it may not be bad speakers, but you got bad listeners. And I'm one of the bad listeners, you know. And sometimes I listen to somebody, you know, and it's one of them people that you ain't feeling. And then people be going up to him and be thanking him. Ooh, you say, I'll be like, don't be encouraging him. You know, that's selfish and self-centered, you know, selfish, self-centered, you know, to the extreme, you know, and so it's some people. But the thing about Alcoholics Anonymous, when you have speakers come out, you know, this is the deal about AA. It's different than anything else. The way that I reconcile that for myself, the different speakers and some of them I ain't feeling, the way I reconcile that for myself, it's like going to a concert. The difference in AA, as opposed to going to a concert, you don't usually go to a concert that crosses all the genres. You don't go to a concert that's got Snoop on the bill, you know, and then it's got like Garth Brooks on the bill. You know, you don't go to that and Metallica on the bill. No, you got Snoop, you got Dre, you know, that country over you, but at Alcoholics Anonymous, you at a concert and it's got all the different genres that come up when you go to a participation meeting. And so for me, sometime when I'm sitting out there and somebody's up at the podium and I ain't feeling, I'm like, oh, yeah, they rapping. You know, that's it. And it'd be some people nod, and then I'd be, oh, okay, they like rap. And then some other people be, oh, that's opera. You know, okay. It'd be some people that like, oh, that's country. And then sometime a speaker be up there, oh, that's old school. That's blues. That's R&B. That's jazz. You know, that's okay. And then sometime you get them transcendent people. Streisand, Michael, everybody be nice. And so that's how it is. So sometimes when it's, I'm like, okay, that's just not my flavor, but somebody's feeling it. You know, and so I started making it easy for myself to go to meetings, Alcoholics Anonymous. You know, and that's how I am. So for me, though, basically, not so much the genres, but there are two kinds of speakers. I call them head speakers and heart speakers. I'm a head guy. I'm a figure-outer. I like figuring stuff out. I like analyzing stuff. I like, you know, okay, you know, the figure-outers are the people that count how many musts there are in the big book Alcoholics Anonymous, you know, how many times it says, you know, and are you recovered, ED, or are you recovering, you know, those, you know, get caught up in those kind of discussions. Some of y'all, ooh, I don't mean to step on toes, you know, keep on doing it if you're doing it. When you first get in the book, those are really, you know, those are really important discussions to have, the stones, cornerstone keys, you know, those are important distinctions to make, Ralph, you know, so don't, I'm not making light of that, but those are the heads speakers, and then you have heart speakers. A brother in my home group, a brother named Brother, used to say, when heart speaks, heart hears. And in Alcoholics Anonymous, we speak the language of the heart. And most of the time, I fall in that category. Even though I'm a head guy, I like to be heart guy. So the reason I say that is the disclaimer. I don't know what I'm going to talk about. I don't never know what I'm going to talk about. I just know I'm a kid from South Central Los Angeles. I got five brothers. We grew up in a little two-bedroom apartment, moms and pops in one room, six boys in three bunk beds in the other room. Earliest memory of my old man was he was an alcoholic, and I didn't want to be like him. My father wasn't abusive, and he wasn't violent. He was an absentee drunk, and every other Friday you knew he would not show up with a check. It would be a kid in the neighborhood felt like it was their duty to tell my family how my old man had performed up at the pool hall. I would feel embarrassed. I would feel ashamed. Those are feelings that dog me for the longest, you know. Pops got put out when I was 8 or 9 years old. Mom's raised six boys by herself. Don't know about you guys, but when I grew up, ideal family life, you took it from the TV programs of the day. And the TV programs when I was growing up that showed ideal families, Father Knows Best, Leave It to Beaver, My Three Sons, Ozzie and Harriet, Donna Reed, wasn't jumping off in my house. When you grown, you get something that's called perspective, and perspective works like this. You got a mom that raised six boys by herself. My mother back in the 60s was on welfare, old Southern Baptist sister, and she refused to settle for a lot. And my mom put herself back through high school. She put herself through college. She worked two jobs. She took in clothes that she washed and ironed for other folk. And when you grown, you look back on your life and say, damn, I had a hell of a mom. Look how she sacrificed to raise her boys. But when you were a kid, about 9 or 10 years old, and you coming home from school on a Wednesday afternoon with a couple of your buddies, and you hit the front door, and mom's is in the living room with an ironing board up and a rag on her head, you don't feel proud. You feel ashamed and embarrassed, and you stop bringing partners home from school. And if your name is Ralph, you start living in the prison I've lived in much of my life, and that's the prison of what I think you think about me. I don't know what you think about me, but I'm trapped in what I think you think about me, and I will do whatever it takes to shape and form and mold your opinion of Ralph. I'll whine you, I'll dine you, I'll woo you, I'll con you, I'll bully you, I'll manipulate you, I'll buy you. Please like me. Now, I don't particularly have to like your ass, but please like me. So I'm growing up like that. I'm a kid in South Central. You know, some of you, my brother Ron talked out here at the Atlanta Roundup maybe a year or two ago, so some of you might have heard Ron's story. Ronnie talks a lot in AA, too. And when you, and literally, Ronnie's a year younger than me chronologically, 3 months older than me in recovery. We slept in the same bed, literally, same household. Came out with two different perspectives on life. You know, when Ronnie shares in his story, he always shares he wanted to be somebody else, someplace else, doing something else. I, on the other hand, could not imagine being anybody other than me. I couldn't imagine being anybody other than a young brother growing up in Watts in the 60s. It was a changing time. It was a turbulent time. And I was going to be somebody. I was going to make a difference in my community. And I was going to be somebody. You know, so, and the reason I share that story, you know how people will say, I'm not going to share a lone drunk log. Everybody knows how to drink. We don't share our stories because we're trying to give a primer on drinking. We don't share our stories because we're trying to teach people how to drink or how not to drink, you know. But our story, there are as many different portraits of the alcoholic as there are alcoholics, you know. And so Ronnie comes out, same place, same environment, whole different way. So the reason I share that is I'm not here to report to you guys tonight that I'm an alcoholic because I'm a product of a broken home. You know, somebody in here grew up with both parents in the house. I'm not here to report to you tonight that I'm an alcoholic, you know, because my daddy was an alcoholic. Somebody in here grew up with parents that never touched it. I'm not here to report to you tonight I'm an alcoholic because I'm a poor kid from the ghetto. Look around the room. You know that ain't the only reason. I'm not here to report to you tonight I'm an alcoholic because we didn't have no money. Somebody in this room grew up with a silver spoon. I'm here to report to you tonight that I'm an alcoholic for two reasons and two reasons only. One, when I take one, I can't tell you when I'm going to stop. Two, when I sincerely don't want to put it in me and start it up again, I put it in me and start it up again anyway. I'm bodily and mentally different. That's it. That's all. The rest is my story. My story goes a little bit like this. Every single one of you had me in your classroom. I was usually class president or student body president. I was a straight-A student. I was teacher's pet. I played ball. I made all-stars. On the outside, I should have been okay. On the inside, I've always felt like if you really knew me, you wouldn't like me. Yeah, I was teacher's pet. Yeah, I was straight-A student. Would have traded it all in if I could have been cool. If I just could have been cool, because in my neighborhood, it was a whole lot more currency placed on cool than on smart. Some of the cool cats are in here right now. I see you. You were the ones in the bathroom, you know, in the bathroom smoking cigarettes, shooting dice, taking quarters from guys like me that brought extra quarters with them, and you knew how to talk to girls, and girls were a mystery to me. Fellas, I don't know why it was that early on in life you guys had a handle on this manhood thing that I just didn't seem to have got the manual. I didn't have the instruction guide. 13 years old, cats would be talking about throwing down with girls already. I didn't know y'all were lying, but I would be thinking to myself, you know. I would be thinking to myself, how come I don't know? You know, it took me a while to get comfortable telling my story in Alcoholics Anonymous. You know, because this is the first place I ever landed where folk try to out-bottom each other, right? And I wanted a penitentiary story without going to the pen to get one, you know. But my story's my story, and I'm not willing to go get another one. And you know, let me step here. I got a penitentiary story now, though, in sobriety. I got a penitentiary story, and some of you guys, I share that story with you. A lot of you guys are H&I giants, and you go inside our institutions. And in my 30-some-odd year, I had never been inside. And so a couple of months ago, you know, I went inside Soledad Prison. They had the third annual AA convention in Soledad Penitentiary. They had a convention, and they brought us in over 3 days, and I got renewed. I got reinvigorated. I ran into cats that were talking about being freer on the yard than they were in the street. I looked at what it is that we do, our fellowship, our society, what it is that we do, the impact we make. I got blown away. So now I got a penitentiary story. I'm going to have to take that out of my story now. But, you know, I still like that line. I wanted a penitentiary story without going to the pen to get it. So I'm going to keep saying it. But anyway, let's go back. You know, I'm 16 years old. I ain't touched nothing. For some of you guys, I know that's late. You know, 16, I get a girlfriend at 16. Now, Ralph with a girlfriend at 16 don't mean the same thing it means for some of you cats. Ralph with a girlfriend at 16 simply means this. I ran with a crew of dudes, went with the same group of girls. One of my boys broke up with this girl. I waited a little time to pass, told my other boy I want to go with her. He came back and told me, she said, yeah, now I got a girlfriend. I'd had other girlfriends before, but this one actually knew she was my girlfriend, right? Don't know what to do with it. But this particular night, I go out on a double date. Me and my girl in the back seat, older partner of mine, him and his girl in the front seat, he driving. Plastic Copa rum and coke come to the back seat this particular night, drank it down real warm, rushed back to the top of my brain. All of a sudden, Ralph's hands started doing things they had never done. Mouth started saying things that it never said. I had arrived. Alcohol did for me what I couldn't do for myself, gave me the courage to do and to be and to say things I wouldn't do, be and say without it, and I liked it. I liked it a lot. The big book, Alcoholics Anonymous, talks about me in lots of places, and it starts talking about me in the front of our book. If we have any new friends in here, we have a chapter in the front of our book called The Doctor's Opinion. And there's a line in The Doctor's Opinion that jumped out at me the first time I read it. Men and women like me drink essentially for the effect produced by alcohol. That's why I drink. I'm not overnight alcoholic. I understand we talk about this disease being progressive in nature, because that's how I showed up in my experience. That first night I drank, I didn't get pissy drunk. I didn't throw up all over myself. I didn't make a fool out of myself. I got a warm, tipsy feeling. I kissed and licked and sucked on my girl in some places I had never done before, you know. And that's how my drinking stayed. I would drink to go out on the weekends and party. I graduated from high school in 71, and I graduated to higher education in every sense of the word. 71, I'm still just drinking on the weekends to party. By the end of 71, I'm drinking not only on the weekends, but I'm the night of the weekend, but I'm drinking during the day to get ready for the party that night. By 1972, I'm drinking not only on the weekends, but now I'm drinking during the week after class, and I've added some non-addictive marijuana to the mix. By the end of 72, I'm drinking and I'm smoking herb and I'm selling herb. By 1973, I'm drinking, I'm smoking herb, I'm selling herb, I'm doing other drugs. I'm doing it on a daily basis, and you could not have told me it was anything wrong with the way I was living. The big book, Alcoholics Anonymous, talks about at a certain point in my drinking career, I won't be able to tell the truth from the false. And the way that worked for me was this. Isn't the way that I'm doing it, isn't that the way everybody does it? Why would you be young, with a bright future, with a little bit of money, then chasing women and getting loaded come with the territory? In those days, man, if you came over to my house and I couldn't offer you something to drink or something to smoke, I wasn't being a good host. And if I went over to your house and you didn't do the same for me, not only weren't you being a good host, I wasn't coming over to your house no more. For what? We didn't have nothing to talk about. You know, in 2018, you know, no disrespect to our young friends. I don't mean new friends. I mean young friends. I'm glad I grew up at the time I grew up. I'm glad I came up in the year I came up. I came up late 60s, early 70s. You go to concerts, you didn't even have to know your neighbor. You just passing it. 2018, you know, and even though in those days, man, in the early 70s, this country was going through a lot. It was a crazy time, but in some ways it was a simpler time. 2018, you got to practice safe sex. You got deadly sexually transmitted disease. Man, back in those days, I'd go to a club, I'd have a one-question interview for a girl. You get high? If not, next. I don't want to know your name. I don't want to know your last name. I don't need to know your sign. I don't need to know your mommy. You know, let's get to the basis of this relationship. Are you getting down like I'm getting down? And that's just the way that it was. I came around this program. I'm going to step over here for a minute. I came around the program four times before I came this thing. And there are some thin lines in the program of Alcoholics Anonymous. And some of the thinnest of lines can make most of the difference. And one of the thin lines that makes all the difference is there's a thin line between comparing and identifying. And my earliest efforts of doing this thing, I would always compare and I would never identify. And I couldn't find myself in the Big Book Alcoholics Anonymous, and I couldn't find myself in any of you guys' stories. I would read the Big Book Alcoholics Anonymous, I read Bill's story. First thing I say, Bill, older white guy, miss me on that. You know, Bill is a veteran of foreign wars, Vietnam era draft dodger. You know, Bill is a Wall Street stockbroker. Check out the way I handle money. You know, Bill in his story wrote, there had been no real infidelity. Miss me on that one, too. You know, so I would always find all the differences. And when I came back to Alcoholics Anonymous to stay, somebody taught me how to read the Big Book Alcoholics Anonymous. And they said, Ralph, the same way that you read the Big Book Alcoholics Anonymous is the same way you listen to our members share their experience, strength, and hope at the meetings. And when you read the Big Book Alcoholics Anonymous and when you listen to our members share their stories, ask yourself three or four questions. Ask yourself, did I drink like he drank? Did I think like he thought? Did I feel like he felt? Or did I do what he did? And when I read Bill's story in the light of those questions, I found my story. Just like Bill, I'm at this major university, and the drive for success was on. I proved to the world I was important. Just like him, drink started taking a more important and exhilarating part in my life. Bill in his story said something real strange. He said, out of this alloy of drink and speculation, out of this combination of his thinking and his drinking, he would later forge a weapon that would turn on him like a boomerang and all but cut him to ribbons. I don't talk like that. Old folk had a shortcut version for that one. They just used to say, trouble always starts out like fun. And you couldn't have told me when I'm up in the dorms, drinking that Annie Green Springs, drinking that, you know, Tyrolia, drinking that, you know, Brass Monkey, you know, drinking that Boone's Farm. You know, you couldn't have told me that alcohol was going to have its way with me. It did what it is that it does. And I stumbled up out of that school some kind of way. And I started working as a counselor for L.A. City Schools. And even though I had the kind of job that should have allowed me to acquire what normal people acquired, I never did that. Snapshot of Ralph's life, this is when alcohol was working. I buy a car, I make exactly 3 car payments, then come find him. First time I had a car repossessed, I had the nerve to call LAPD. 9 months behind on the note. Next 2 times, I didn't even trip, I already knew. I'm the kind of brother that never had a problem balancing a bank book. Hey there, I got money. 2 days later, broke. 0. No problem balancing my bank book. You know, stayed in the crib from 1976 to 1979 without paying rent. Couple of baffling features about the disease I suffer from, one of them is this. I can't see my relationship with alcohol until I'm free of it. I can't see what it's doing to me when I'm in the mix. So some of the things that are crystal clear to me now, looking back in the rearview mirror of experience, were not at all clear to me when I was going through them. One fact stands out real clear to me about the days I thought alcohol was working. I used to go to work for 2 weeks to live for 2 days. That's it. That's all. Can't tell you the day or the time or the hour. Can't tell you where I was or what I was doing. When alcohol ceased to be a luxury for me and became a necessity, I can tell you that it did. You know what I don't like about the invisible line? It's invisible. It ain't nothing to say. If you take this next one, you enter in the region from which there's no return through human. And it ain't nothing to say that. You know, the cold thing about the disease I suffer from is this. By the time you realize it's a line, right, you way over. Who put that line? You way over here somewhere. And the cold thing about the disease I suffer from is this. By the time I realize I have a problem and need to do something about it, it's already too late for me to do something about it. Cold thing. Got married April of 1980, Saturday afternoon. Had a bachelor party the night before my wedding. None of the guys at the bachelor party are getting married the next day. All of them have sense enough to go home at 2 or 3 o'clock in the morning. I'm still at my bachelor till 7:30 in the morning, right, me and my brothers. Get me up at 10 o'clock for my 1 o'clock wedding. I'm tore up. I'm tore up. I'm supposed to say my own vows at this wedding, right? They get me up. They get me to the wedding. I show up, and I'm staggering, and it must have been so severe that my then-wife-to-be took one look at me stumbling, and she looked at the preacher. She said, okay, scratch the own vow. Say the regular on him, right? Now my lines are cut to two words, you know. We get into the ceremony. It gets to me. I get ready. I threw up all over. Passed out. Have not taken a wedding picture to this day. Pitiful and incomprehensible demoralization. New friends, if you're anything like me, when I first hit the rooms, although the words you guys use in the rooms are not unfamiliar to me, the way you guys use them is not the way I use them in my everyday walk-around vocabulary. You guys are talking about a psychic change, phenomena, craving, this allergy of the body. And the way you guys use all of it, I needed some help with. But the first time I heard pitiful and incomprehensible demoralization, didn't need no help with that one. Folk like us don't need a dictionary for pitiful, incomprehensible demoralization. I lived pitiful, incomprehensible demoralization up close and personal, and I lived it over and over and over and over again. See, I'm the kind of father, and I'm the kind of husband. Remember sitting on my living room couch. Wife coming out the bathroom real fast, pulling her pants up. She'd go to the dining room table, pick her purse up off that table, clutch it real close as she went back to the bathroom. And I feel this tall because nobody was in the house but me and her, but it got like that in my house. I'm the kind of father and I'm the kind of husband. Remember coming home and sticking my key in the door. Wife and two-year-old daughter sitting here and they both crying. I look over here and homeboy sitting in my seat. He's got a gun pointed at my stomach talking about I want my money right now. Fellas, I don't know about the rest of you guys, but I always had a lot of fears and a lot of doubts about, do I have what it takes to be a father? Do I have what it takes to be a husband? And if you're in the life, your track record already gives you an answer, right? Because what's the father's role and what's the husband's role? To protect and to provide. And it's a cold-blooded feeling, fellas. Laying in bed with a woman night after night after night after night. Knowing not only aren't you protecting, knowing not only aren't you providing, you the one bringing the wolf to the door. See, I'm the kind of father and I'm the kind of husband. Remember sitting on my back porch. Two-year-old daughter coming outside pulling in my coat. Daddy, daddy, that's my piggy bank. I remember stopping and giving her a little grin. Don't worry, baby. Daddy's going to put some dollar bills in here for this change. And I wasn't raised to be stealing from my daughter, and I wasn't raised to be stealing from my wife. I was an alcoholic with no tools of recovery. And I did what it took to get what I needed to get. Share with you that my disease is progressive in nature, and in my experience, it's progressive in a couple of areas. Share one area already. It takes more than it used to take in order for me to get the same effect. But my disease is progressive in another area, my behavior. My behavior gets progressively worse. I'm willing to do more readily chase this thing. First time I had my wife's purse, if you would hook me up to a poly, I would have passed when I said, I'm just taking this $40. I'm going to replace it before she knows it's missing. And I'm in it. Because I don't steal. Took that $40, spent it up, came back looking for some more money. She had moved the purse. I couldn't believe I had hit the purse like that. Couldn't believe it, so I didn't look for it. Told you guys that this deal of ours, everything about it, I took to. Everything about it. Sometimes I think about how fragile the ties are that hold us right now, how we almost aren't here tonight, and what that would mean. 1934 in December, guy showed up at the same hospital we had been in several times previously. Doctor saw him, here he come again, told his old lady, get a black dress. Bill ain't gonna make it probably this time. If he does, he's gonna have to be locked up or he's gonna go crazy. Bill said that he heard the doctor say that and he almost welcomed the idea. But something happened that December in 1934 to that gentleman in Towns Hospital. And what happened to him in his hospital bed that night scared him. Scared him so much he talked about it to the doctor the next day. He said, doctor, and he recounted what had happened to him in his room. This experience he had had. Check this out. The doctor, from the outside looking in, wasn't with him, didn't have the experience, none of that. From the outside looking in, when Bill Wilson recounted what had happened, the doctor said, dude, I don't know what it is that happened to you, but you would look good holding on to it. Bill Wilson left Towns Hospital that December in 1934, and he started looking for people like me and you. 6 months' time, nobody sober. He out there preaching. Dude, you need to have this white light experience. You need to have this. And they like, man, you messing up my heart. Keep it moving. Go, 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 go. Ain't nobody trying to hear that, you know. And Bill gets discouraged. But in that 6 month period, some of his people he used to do business with put together a business opportunity. They said, Bill, we want you to represent our interests out of town. We want you to travel down to Akron, Ohio, carry this proxy for us. And he went down and they said, if this business comes off, you'll be set. And he needed to be set. He had been taking him and his wife through it. And he went down to Akron, Ohio, and his business did not come off too well. And he found himself in a hotel lobby, and he got thirsty. He could see the bar from the lobby, could hear the ice clinking in the glasses. And a thought came. It still blows me away, the series of events that happened to have us here tonight. A thought came, strange thought, funny thought. Thought came, I need to find a drunk not to drink. I ain't never had a thought like that. I done looked for many drunks in my time, never not to drink. I need to find a drunk not to drink. And instead of being sorry for himself, instead of feeling like I knew this wasn't going to happen, this sober thing ain't for me. You know, soon as I get my hopes up, instead of going there, he said yes to the idea of finding a drunk. Blows me away. He said yes to the idea of finding a drunk. And through a series of divine coincidences, he got put in touch with a lady who had a husband like us. And he talked to Ann Smith. He said, I understand you got a husband who got a drinking problem. I'd like to meet with him. Dr. Bob was passed out. His wife said, a dude want to talk to you. He said, I'll give him 15 minutes tomorrow. And they met that next day, and that 15 minutes turned into about 4.5 or 5 hours. And those two gentlemen set about looking for people like us. And in 2 years' time, they had found about 40 people staying sober. About 40 people. And I like to think that that New York hustler must have looked at the Akron physician and said to him, how are we going to let Ralph White know when it's his time? And they said, we'll put it in a book. And they put me in that book. Put me in that book. They started writing that book in about 1937, finished publishing it in 1939. I got here to this earth sometime after that, and I got here to you guys even later than that, and they put me in that book. 2 weeks after I said I'm going to replace this money before she knows it's missing, same scenario. I'm out doing what I do, spent up all my money, came back looking for some more money, and the idea of replacing the money didn't come to mind. They got a line in that book that describes me to a T. They said, we don't know why, but the alcoholic at certain times will be unable to recall with sufficient force pain, suffering, humiliation weeks, even days ago. The idea of replacing the money didn't come to mind. I got replaced with a new thought. I said, last time I took 40, came back looking for some money, she moved the purse. This time I'll take all the money out the purse, and that I don't spend up, I'll sneak it back in the purse. Off and running to hit my wife's purse on a regular, did it one too many times, came home one day, screen door was locked, note on the screen, the rest of your stuff is at your mama's house, suitcase on the porch, I'm put out of my house, I'm now my daddy. Over the course of the next year, my five brothers got put out their respective homes. All of us ended up in my mom's house, and we damn near killed her. You know, when I got put out of my house and went to stay at my mom's house, my ex-wife thought it was something salvageable about this piece of man she married. And she would bring my daughter over so we could keep a father-daughter relationship. She would bring her over on Saturdays. And I wanted to be a father to my little girl with everything in me. I really, really, really did. I wanted to take my girl to Disneyland. I wanted to take her to Magic Mountain. I wanted to take her to a movie on a Saturday afternoon. I wanted to walk up the street with her little hand in my big hand, take her to the store and buy her some ice cream. I wanted to sit her in my lap and read stories to her. I wanted to tuck her in bed at night and get a good night kiss. I wanted to get the look from my little girl that I've seen men in the fellowship get, the look like this is my daddy and this is my hero. And the best I could do on those Saturdays was 30 minutes. 30 minutes. Tell my mom something like I'm going to the store to buy Rain some ice cream. I'd disappear. Sneak back on Sunday night when her mom was coming to get her. Can still remember some of them long Sunday nights, man, sticking my head around the side of my mom's house, tears flowing. And I see those two heads in the car and those headlights backing out the driveway. And through the tears, I'd be thinking to myself, there goes my life backing out this driveway. Heard a lot of people say they were scared of dying out there. Not my story. Never scared of dying, scared I was going to keep waking up to the same old thing, Monday the same as Tuesday, the same as Sunday, the same as Christmas, over and over and over again. And I'm so glad God don't make misery comfortable. And on October 11th, 1986, I got miserable enough. I got tired enough. I got directed to my fourth program of recovery. I went to the Harbor Light Center on Skid Row in downtown Los Angeles. And that October in 1986, I was in a real bad way and I was in a real dark place. I was full of regret and I was full of remorse and I was full of I'd never be able to forgive myself for the things I had done and what I had become. Hadn't looked at myself full face in the mirror in over a year. Took me to a meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous they brought into the facility that first weekend I was in there. Speaker was standing up in front of the group somewhat like I am tonight. And he was sharing about taking from the job and he was sharing about taking from the family. And I remember looking at him and thinking to myself, yeah, you sharing about doing scandalous things, but you look scandalous. You should have been doing that. I'm different. Y'all ain't gonna hear my business. And the speaker seemed like he knew I was in the room. He read my mail. He dropped something on me like this. He said, if you're sitting in this room right now, you are not responsible for your recovery, but you are not responsible for your disease, but you are responsible for your recovery. And you have just now tapped into a source of power much greater than yourself. And you don't have to drink and you don't have to use no matter what, provided you are willing to fulfill some conditions. Speaker that night caught my attention. He went on to say, this is the only club you can be a member of where the worse off you are when you get here, better off your chances of staying. Got the message of hope from the first meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous they took me to. Dude described to me what I suffered from. He did it in a strange way. It's what we do. I've never seen anything like it. I still don't see anything to duplicate it. Dude was talking about me, talking about himself. I've never seen it. Let me share some things with you. Let me share some anatomical facts about a guy named Ralph. Unfortunately, when you get me to come out to speak, I'm not the speaker that's going to say everything I share, you know, if it don't come from the big book, you're going to get Ralph White. You're going to get all of him. You're going to get some of my experiences. Most of them I try to square with the big book Alcoholics Anonymous. Or you're going to get some of my experiences with some of you guys' experience. But you're going to get all of me. Now, and you won't get this from the big book Alcoholics Anonymous, but you'll get this from the big book of Ralph White's experience. I'm going to share some anatomical facts I learned about a guy named Ralph. I learned that when my ass is raw, my ears open and my mouth closes. When my behind starts healing, my mouth starts running and my ears start closing. Thank God I was tenderized well enough, long enough this last time. When I got back, I heard the music. I was sitting up in the front of the room. That speaker was sitting up and seemed like he was talking directly to me. And in a good way, I was taking it personal. Dude was talking about it, something physically different, and seemed like he invited me to diagnose myself. Ralph, don't take my word for it. Ask yourself, how many times did you say, I'm just going to spend 20? What happened? Whole paycheck. How many times did you say, I'm going to stop off over here at my boy Jerry's house for a minute? What happened? Whole paycheck. How many times did you say, I'm just going to go to happy hour? What happened? Whole paycheck. Ralph, did it happen once? Did it happen twice? If your name is Ralph, every 2 weeks from 1979 to 1985, whole paycheck. My experience, not yours, not my sponsors, not the oldest old timer. My experience abundantly confirms for me when I take one of anything, no matter where I have to go, who I have to see, what I have to do, no matter how great the wish or the necessity, my body takes over and I have to have another. Okay, smart guy, it's just my body. How do you explain stone sober? My car seemed to drive to the LIQ on payday. Second part of this disease, the obsession that somehow, someday, I will be able to control and enjoy this magic potion I discovered. Where is that coming from? Somebody help me. Where is this control and enjoy coming from? Check this out. Anytime I was controlling, I wasn't enjoying. Anytime I was enjoying, I damn sure wasn't controlling. You know, I can't. Where is that coming from? I can't drink because of my body. I can't not because my mind refuses to accept that fact. I'm powerless. Third part is disease, spiritual malady. 12 and 12 describes it as a soul sickness. And in the big book, Alcoholics Anonymous, it says, Ralph, if you work on the spiritual, the mental, and the physical are straightened out, that's what we do. Don't get scared. That was a chilling thought for me. I kind of like the speaker when he gets to the point, you know, the worse off you are when you, I like all that. But you're getting ready to hit me with the G word, Mr. Speaker. I'm not feeling that. I didn't come here for that. That's all right for you guys. You don't understand me. You know, yeah, with your 31 years, that God word just slides out your mouth. But that ain't something I'm feeling. Check this out. You know, I did not come and be, you know, check this out. I did not come up in here walking toward the light. I came up in here running from the fire. And if your ass is on fire, this is the place for you to be too. Did not come up in here expecting any of what it is that I got. You know, when I came up in here, all I wanted was to get it off me. All I wanted was to get it off me. I got so much more than that. You know, because I'm not, and check this out. Even though I'm talking about this spiritual part, I'm not knocking physical sobriety. You know, I'm not knocking physical sobriety. If you just don't drink and you just don't use, you might stop going to jail on the weekends. If you just don't drink and you just don't use, you might make it home with a whole paycheck. If you just don't drink and you just don't use, you might make it to work on Monday morning. But what this program has to offer is so much more than that. What this program is really about is about obtaining and maintaining access to a source of power that does for me what I can't do for myself. What this program is really about is about obtaining and maintaining access to a source of power that can do anything but fail. What this program is really about, you want to see Alcoholics Anonymous? We're a visual age. We're a visual society. Everything is instantaneous. Let's take a selfie right now. You want to see Alcoholics Anonymous? You want to take an Alcoholics Anonymous selfie right now? You want to see what the program is? Take a look around this room right now. What this program is really about is about taking people like us, drunks and boosters and convicts and con artists, you know, failures as parents, failures as kids, broken down pieces of men and women who don't have dreams and goals and hopes anymore. This program takes people like us, and it puts us together in one room. And I stick one hand in your hand, another hand in God's hand. And we pick up our beds and we walk out of these rooms as mothers and fathers and sisters and brothers, sons, daughters, employees, employers, role models in our community. This program is about growth. This program is about change. If there are going to be any changes made in my life, it begins and it ends with me. I'm a guy that I'm in love with this deal. I'm not the one that's going to try to scare you in the recovery. If you go back out there still kicking it, you know, and what I used to think of as my heyday, people used to look at the way I was getting down and be like, damn, man, ain't you scared of overdose? And I'd be like, scared of overdose? I'm scared of the deadly underdose. You better put some more up on here, you know. So the message of fear ain't the message of the whole alcoholic of my variety. The big book Alcoholics Anonymous talks about a guy like me. And it says the message that interests a guy like me is a message that's got to have depth and that's got to have weight. The message tonight's speaker brings that's got the most depth and the most weight, you're looking at a guy who at 33 years old had given up on life. You're looking at a guy who at 33 years old did not know where his little girl was enrolled in school and didn't know where his family was living. You're looking at a guy who at 33 years old had not answered anybody's 8 o'clock or 9 o'clock wake up call to go to work and so long I no longer thought I was employable. You're looking at a guy who came from a major university in this country, and my job at the end was taking the trash out for a 21-year-old. I was sleeping in the back of my mother's garage, and I was eating lemons off a neighbor's lemon tree for breakfast. And the men and women in this fellowship, the fellowship I crave, the men and women in this fellowship nursed me and loved me back to health. You gave me a way out upon which we all agree, and you gave me something. You know, you started sharing some things with me, and I'm a guy that's a big proponent of that, you know. I'm dead serious, you know, and if you in here right now, and you I'm a guy, I'm dead serious about recovery, but I'm seldom serious in recovery. If you ain't laughing in this program, you ain't taking this program serious enough. You know, I'm a firm believer in that. I was with a guy, you know, 55 years at the time, we were on a Q&A panel, and they asked Tom, what's the most important thing you found in your 55 years of recovery? And he surprised me. He didn't say a conscious contact with it. He didn't say anything long and flowery. He said one word. Most important thing you found in your 55. He said enthusiasm. Enthusiasm. All you sponsors out there, you thumpers. God damn it, if it's supposed to be a program of attraction, make it attractive. Don't be getting up here, there ain't no easier software. No, this is the, this is it. This is it. And I'm glad. You know, we got some good news and we got some bad news. The good news is there is a way out. The bad news is you looking at it. You know, you right here. This is it. It don't get no better than this. You know, Alcoholics Anonymous, you hear a speaker, Alcoholics Anonymous is the only organization that don't give referrals. There ain't no place. We don't give referrals. You know, this is it. This is it. But I'm so grateful and I'm so glad. And I didn't know it. You know, when I first came up in here, you know, I'm a guy, you know, and we're going to talk about this a lot, you know, tomorrow. And I don't know who's going to be able to get out there. And we'll talk some more about that. But I'm passionate about this deal, man. You know, I got my feet put on a path to really go somewhere. You know, I'm going to share something. I don't know if we have any new members. But if we have some new friends, let me invite you to put some things in your simple kit of spiritual tools. First thing I want you to put in your simple kit of spiritual tools, get a sobriety day. You ain't got one, you don't have one. Somebody walk up to you and say, what's your sobriety date? You say, you ain't got one. You know. Get a sobriety date. Then get a home group. Home group is somewhere you go, something like a Cheers bar, somewhere you go where everybody know your name, you know. Then get a sponsor. These days, we put a lot on sponsorship. Get a sponsor who has a sponsor who has working. And I'll be thinking, that's a lot to, you know, interviewing techniques to give a newcomer. But, you know, but I'm not knocking sponsorship. It is vital. It's vital to us. But here's the deal. There's power in that transaction. There's power in that conversation. There's power in that. It don't matter if you move on from the sponsor, if you outgrow that sponsor, if you move someone, get a sponsor. There's power in the transaction. Because we see you. We know you when you come up in here. I'm a grown-ass man. Can't nobody tell you. We know. That's why you up in here with us. Can't nobody tell you nothing. You know, grown-ass. It's something about saying, help me. Something about finally saying, I don't know. Done. Get a sponsor. Then get a road dog. Road dog is something different than a sponsor. Sometimes sponsorship turns into road dog, but initially, you know, get a road dog. I had a couple, my brother Ron and my boy Strange. See, a road dog is something different because, you know, you ain't probably going to be running with your sponsor initially. Plus, you be coming on, you know, you come, you know how you try to come correct with your sponsor. No, sir, I'm not looking at girls at the meeting, you know. But with your dog, you'd be like, man, you see them honeys at that meeting? We're going back to that meeting. You know, that's what you talk about your sponsor to. Is your road dog, you know. So get a road dog. I had my boy Strange and Ronnie, and we've been on this path. And we've all of us been on it for over 31 years, man. And we made this thing fun. And we made this thing alive. You know, we saw some people that came to, you know, that came to a marathon meeting. And they were presenting the big book in a way I'd never seen it before. And we asked two of the members of that group what they do it for us. And me and Ron went to my mom, and we were both staying at my mom's house. We both had a little over a year sober. This was in 1987, November. And we asked our mom if we could open the door. And my mom's, and you know, she came out our bedroom door one morning going to church on a Sunday morning in November. And her living room was full of these alcoholics sitting at her dining room table. And they had these blue books open. And my mom, with tears in her eyes, said, I want to thank you for my sons. And we started that meeting going through the book page by page, line by line. And we did the 12 steps together as a group. And we liked it. And some people heard about it. And we do what we do when we like something. We do it again. And some more people heard about it. And they said, we want to get out like that. And we did it again. And my mom's little house, we outgrew it in about 5 years. And Sunday morning, probably be about 250, 300 people at the Never Too Early Big Book Workshop. We got off our knees 2 weeks ago. And they'll have notebooks this Sunday. And we'll be writing. Highest caller. Highest caller. I remember about 10 years ago now, and there's some people who, you know, the thing about this deal we do, when you get all the way in it, you get a new name. First name, your name, last name, alcoholic. You never walk alone another day in your life, anywhere you go. About 10 years ago, I was in my third valley. Some people in this room that have had an opportunity to walk with me through my entire, you know, most of my life. We start living out loud in Alcoholics Anonymous. We live a life of transparency, and it's through the transparency that we use with other people. That's why we do what we do. And see, that guy right there, see, I'm going to tell his sponsor on him. Leaving in the middle of the speaker, you know, look at him. Everybody see Jerry Sinatra, you know, but that's one of them. But Jerry's demonstrating what it is we do. He roll over here on a night when he's got a home group meeting, and he roll over here. And he's still going to keep his commitment. In my third valley, 22 years sober. I thought they needed a recovery home for old timers at the time. For the had lost a 20-year marriage, lost all my money, lost my house in front of everybody. In 1988, I got on my knees for the first time with 12 other people. And I said, God, I offer myself to you to build with me and to do with me as you will. I was about 18 months sober. I was not a vision for you. I didn't have a lot. Wasn't working permanently yet. That Ralph White at 18 months sober, if I'd have walked up to any woman in this room and said, baby, I offer myself to you, you'd have been like, dude, keep it moving. Yeah. But I got on my knees in that condition. Because in Alcoholics Anonymous, you ain't got to be right to get right. You ain't got to come right to get right. Come as you are. I got on my knees. Still with a lot of stuff not in order. It don't matter. Get on your knees. Still tricking. Get on your knees. Still get on your knees. Still not. Get on your knees. I got on my knees and I said, God, do something with your boy. Do something with this. I'm turning myself in. I'm giving up on the Ralph idea. And he did something with me. He did something with me. There's a key part in there. He says, take away my difficulties, the victory over them may bear witness to those I would help. See, I learned some things in the valley. I learned some things in that valley because I've never come off that third step. I've never figuratively come off. I'm on my knees figuratively every day as I walk. It may look like it, you know, but that third step is broad. Turning myself in that is power, it's broad. Folk be thinking, damn, every day I turn, okay, I done had a long time with Ralph's will, so it ain't going to look seamless, it ain't going to look graceful, it ain't going to look like, oh, every day he float. No, it's going to look stumbling, it's going to look halting, but I'm moving every day, and that's what we do in these, we stand. And so I came in my 22nd year, when I was sitting up there in that third valley, there's a part I said, take away my difficulties, the victory over there may bear witness to those I was held. See, this thing that this power that I've discovered that you guys introduced me to, that I still don't understand all the time, but it's growing, and I, you know, it don't matter. I'm talking, you know, and this thing about this, and I'm praying, and I'm talking, and I'm talking, and I'm praying. And prayer may not change things for you, and it may not change the situation for you, but it'll change you for things. The conversation will change you for things. And when things come happening, you'll stand. And in that 22nd year, and sometimes my sponsor always says, sometimes you're going to have to be the message that you carry. And if the message that you carry is God can handle anything, guess what? Sometimes you're just going to have something for him to handle. And you guys carried me in that year. And when you in the dark place, when you in it, it seemed like the dark is going to last forever. On the other side, it seemed like it went like that. But my fellowship, you know, I'm not one, and I'm a program guy. I'm a 12-step guy. I'm a big book guy. But I'm not a guy that diminishes any part of the program at the expense of any other part. No. Every single part is important. Because that year of living crying, that year of living, that year right there, fellowship carried me. You know, and none of my sponsees left. You know, and it's easy to say your stuff don't make you till you don't have your stuff. Praying, talking, the rest of that. And I'm a guy, God, you know, God is good to his boy. He don't have, I don't care what goes on in my life. It's only three answers. Yes, not now, or I got something better for you. Yes, not now, or I got something better for you. I remember those days of darkness, and I remember those times when I was like, I don't even want to get up in the morning, and it would just be one thing that would hold me. What make you think God saved you from the cesspool to let you drown in the bathtub? And I found out what it is that we arm with. He worked with me through my adversity. That's what I get. That's what I get. Four phases of my prayer life, they mentioned that, you know, they mirror the four phases of my spiritual development. Phase one, help me. Almost all of us get here on some variation of that prayer. Help me. Phase two, grant me. Give me. Grant me strength as I go. Grant me the serenity. Grant two. Phase two, give me. Phase three, grow me. Phase four, use me. Highest calling in Alcoholics Anonymous. Use me. And those of us who are useful, we useful through our adversity. Ain't nobody hollering at me because of, oh, how many houses I'm doing, how many. No, no, no. People hollering at me because, dude, what happened when you was 20 years old and you got, you know, in front of everybody, you lost your man? What happened to you when the IRS came after you for $80,000? How did you get up and keep walking through that? What happened to you when you lost your house? What happened to you when you went through, what happened to you when you lost all your money? Did you ever do so? You know, I was listening to a tape by this old guy, Franklin Williams. He called himself the Pope of Alcoholics Anonymous. Somebody turned me on to him. And Franklin Williams said something, you know, and he said, you know what? He said, I can lose hope. I can lose friends. I can lose money. He said, I can lose money. He said, but I can't run out of God. Not I won't. Not I run out of money. I run out of friends. I run out of stuff. Can't run out of God. I said, God damn. Ooh. And then I learned it for myself. I'm going to share something. When I'm in this valley, I'm going to O'Hare Airport. I'm in O'Hare Airport. I'm traveling to a deal to talk about the third step, right? Made a decision to turn my will. I'm going to talk about God. Got a call from my college roommate. He had lost his dad. Called my college roommate. He had lost his dad. I'm calling him, offering condolences and stuff. And we talking. Strange feeling hit me when we were on the phone. Because my friend hadn't lost nothing. Still had his property, still had his money, moving his daughter into a guest house behind his. And usually, I rejoice in successes. Something was happening. I'm getting mad every time I heard him. It felt like a knife sticking me in the stomach. I get off the phone, I'm crying in O'Hare Airport. Can't pray. The last thing I wanted to do was see one of y'all walk through O'Hare and say, this too shall pass. You know how when sometimes you just don't even want to hear that, man, you need to, you know, I'm like that. I can't pray. I don't know God's number. It's like when you don't have no cell reception. Sometimes you don't have no grace reception. Too much resentment, no grace reception. Too much anger, no grace reception. Too anger, resentment, and self-pity all together, no grace, can't pray. But I'm going to tell you about trained feet. That's what you do in Alcoholics Anonymous. You train your feet. Train your feet. Disease centers in my thinking. Recovery centers in my feet. Train your feet. I got trained feet. I don't care what's going on with me. I call somebody. I call my sponsor. I call a closed-mouth friend. In this case, my sponsor wasn't around. Hit one of my boys up. I'm crying on the phone. I'm not a crying man, but I'm a crying man. Crying on the phone. This is what happened. When you hit one of them dead zones in your recovery, too much resentment, too much fear, too much anger, too much self-pity, too much. When you hit one of them dead zones, when you can't pray on your own, I'm going to give you a secret. I called my boy, and he three-wayed me. Guy got on the line. It's what happens in Alcoholics Anonymous when two or more of us get together. That's why we don't do this thing by ourselves. He got on the line. I guarantee you when two or more of us get there, he's on the line. Look how many of us are together right now. He's on the line. Always. On the line. And I learned that one for myself. And you guys carried me through that year, man. And I'm a God. Came through that. Renewed. Rejuvenated. And glad that you guys have done for me what you've done for me. You know, I don't always know whether I'm deserving of friends like Jerry. Came down, hung out with a brother, then made it to his home group because that's what we do. We keep our commitments. I don't know I'm deserving of what all the people that came up here made me feel welcome. Sometimes I question it. Because you know how the book talks about we're like a tornado roaring through the lives of others. Well, this guy you're looking at to speak in the night. Imagine him and his mom's house with five brothers. All active at once. Forget a tornado, it was like a tsunami. And we damn near killed my mom. So I don't always know that I'm deserving, or I don't always feel like I'm deserving of this gift. But I know my mom is. I know my mom is. There are ripples. I'm going to sit down for me in a minute. Don't know where I went with this. There are ripples. That ain't why we do it. We don't do it for the ripples. But one of the unintended consequences for sitting here is the ripples. Because you looking at me. But when you see me, and trust me, I'm better with you guys. I keep coming to you because I'm better with you than I am by myself. And everything that I am today, I owe to Alcoholics Anonymous. And I don't say it lightly. I don't say it because I'm the speaker. But you see me. But what you don't see when I stand up here, what you don't see is a little 3-year-old boy, before in 2 months, that wouldn't be here if it wasn't for you guys. The ripples. It's a whole lot of grandkids sitting out here that we don't see. This got real grandmamas and you know what, all the grands? Check this out. If I knew they were so much fun, I'd have had them first. You know what I'm saying? The ripples. It's a 23-year-old that's never seen her daddy loaded, and one day at a time, she never will. Graduated from Boston University last May. I remember when she was a sophomore moving out of the dorms and moving into her own crib. You know, and I want you to have your moments, anybody that's new. Many of us have had the grace moments, and we know them now. We don't call them coincidence, and we don't call them, we call it by name. We know when grace comes. And we moving the kids into their crib. She had two roommates, and I had to step in the bathroom. I want you to have your moments. A lot of us have them. I had to step in the bathroom when we were moving the kids into that first apartment, in our first house. She had a house in Boston. because it just hit me. It hit me in an overwhelming way. And I'm crying in the bathroom. I'm like, this is what dads do. They don't go in the piggy bank. They move their little girls into their first crib. The ripples. That girl whose piggy bank I was going in, she's 34 years old right now. Practicing attorney in the state of California. Gave me that grandson. 5 years ago, I walked her down the aisle. Young man came and asked me for a hand. It's a story I don't often tell. He asked me for a hand the Christmas, the year before they got married. And when Arjuna came and asked me for a hand, he said, Pops, his dad is dead. He said, I never thought I'd find a man to replace my dad, but I wish he could have known you. And we were walking down the aisle that wedding day. Music was playing, Rain on My Arm. Piggy bank girl. And she said, Dad, this is the happiest day of my life. I'm sad about one thing. I said, what's that, baby? She said, this is the last day I'll ever be Rain White, but I'll always be Daddy's girl. The ripples. Could have missed it. Could have missed it. Just think about it. You know. These seats right here, if we could see all the lives around us, they say for every one of us, when we out there active, we touch about 10, 11. Just think about when we sober. Just think about when we sober. I always wanted to do something important. I always wanted to do something significant. And I can think of nothing more important than I can think of nothing more significant than being a participating member of the life-saving, life-changing experience that is Alcoholics Anonymous. Whenever anybody anywhere reaches out for help, I want the hand of aid to be there. For that, I'm responsible. Take it real serious. You'll never hear Ralph White say he don't know why he's sober. I know exactly why I'm sober. I get a blessing so that I can be a blessing. Recovery for me is a gift from God. What I do with my recovery, that's my gift to God. My name is Ralph White. I am an alcoholic. Thank you.